two. And the two are probably stoned out of their gourds. Really, it should be a tit. 8. Andy Sanders was stationed behind the same oak he'd used for cover the first time the bitter men came. Although he hadn't taken any grenades, he had 6 ammo clips stuck in the front of his belt, plus 4 more poking into the small of his back. There were another 2 dozen in the wooden crate at his feet, enough to hold off an army. Although he supposed if Big Jim actually sent an army, they'd take him out in short order. After all, he was just a pill roller. One part of him couldn't believe he was doing this. But another part, an aspect of his character he might never have suspected without the meth, was grimly delighted. Outraged, too. The Big Jims of the world didn't get to have everything, nor did they get to take everything away. There would be no negotiation this time, no politics, no backing down. He would stand with his friend, his soulmate. Andy understood that his state of mind was nihilistic, but that was all right. He had spent his life counting the cost, and stoned don't-give-a-shit-itis was a delirious change for the better. He heard trucks approaching and checked his watch. It had stopped. He looked up at the sky and judged by the position of the yellow-white blare that used to be the sun that it must be close to noon. He listened to the swelling sound of diesel engines, and when the sound diverged, Andy knew his compadre had smelled out the play, smelled it out as surely as any wise old defensive lineman on a Sunday afternoon. Some of them were swinging around toward the back of the station to the access road there. Andy took one more deep drag of his current fry daddy, held his breath as long as he could, then huffed it out. Regretfully, he dropped the roach and stepped on it. He didn't want any smoke, no matter how deliciously clarifying, to give away his position. I love you, Chef, Andy Sanders thought, and pushed off the safety of his Kalashnikov. 9. There was a light chain across the rutted access road. Freddy, behind the wheel of the lead truck, did not hesitate, simply hit it and snapped it with the grill. The lead truck and the one behind it, piloted by Mel Searles, headed into the woods. Stuart Bowie was behind the wheel of the third truck. He stopped in the middle of Little Bitch Road, pointed at the WCIK radio tower, then looked at Randolph, who was jammed against the door with his HK semi-auto between his knees. Go on another half mile, Randolph instructed. Then pull up and kill the engine. It was just 11:35. Excellent. Plenty of time.
What's the plan?
Fern asked. The plan is we wait until noon. When we hear shooting, we roll, at once, and take them from behind.
These trucks is pretty noisy, Roger Killian said. What if those guys hear 'em coming? We'll lose that, what do you call it, elephant of surprise.
They won't hear us, Randolph said. They'll be sitting in the station watching television in air-conditioned comfort. They're not going to know what hit them.
Shouldn't we have gotten some bulletproof vests or something?
Stewart asked. Why carry all that weight on such a hot day? Stop worrying. Old Cheech and Chong there are going to be in hell before they even know they're dead. 10. Shortly before 12 o'clock, Julia looked around and saw that Barbie was gone. When she walked back to the farmhouse, he was loading canned goods into the rear of the Sweetbriar Rose van. He'd put several bags in the stolen phone company van as well. What are you doing? We just unloaded those last night. Barbie turned a strained, unsmiling face toward her. I know, and I think we were wrong to do it. I don't know if it's being close to the box or not, but all at once I seem to feel that magnifying glass Rusty talked about right over my head, and pretty soon the sun's going to come out and start shining through it. I hope I'm wrong. She studied him. Is there more stuff? I'll help you if there is. We can always put it back later. Yes, Barbie said, and gave her a strained grin. We can always put it back later. 11. At the end of the access road, there was a small clearing with a long abandoned house in it. Here the two orange trucks pulled up, and the raiding party disembarked. Teams of two swung down long, heavy duffel bags that had been stenciled with the words Homeland Security. On one of the bags, some wit had added, Remember the Alamo, in magic marker. Inside were more HK semi-autos, two Mossberg pump shotguns with 8-round capacity, and ammo, ammo, ammo.
Fred.
It was Stubby Norman.
Shouldn't we have vests or something?
We're hitting them from behind, Stubby. Don't worry about it.
Freddy hoped he sounded better than he felt.
He had a gut full of butterflies.
Do we give him a chance to surrender?
Mel asked.
I mean, Mr. Sands is being a selectman and all?
Freddy had thought about this.
He'd also thought about the honor wall, where photographs of the three Chester's Mills cops who had died in the line of duty since World War II were hung. He had no urge to have his own photo on that wall, and since Chief Randolph hadn't given him specific orders on this subject, he felt free to issue his own.
If their hands are up, they live, he said. If they're unarmed, they live. Anything else, they fucking die. Anyone got a problem with that?
No one did. It was 11:56, almost showtime.
He surveyed his men, plus Lauren Connery, so hard-faced and small-busted she almost could have passed for one, pulled in a deep breath and said, "Follow me, single file. We'll stop at the edge of the woods and scope things out."
Randolph's concerns about poison ivy and poison oak proved groundless, and the trees were spaced widely enough to make the going quite easy, even loaded down with ordnance.
Freddy thought his little force moved through the clumps of juniper they couldn't avoid, with admirable stealth and silence. He was starting to feel that this was going to be all right. In fact, he was almost looking forward to it. Now that they were actually on the move, the butterflies in his stomach had flown away.
Easy does it, he thought. Easy and quiet, then bang. They'll never know what hit him.
12. Chef crouched behind the blue panel truck parked in the high grass at the rear of the supply building. Heard them almost as soon as they left the clearing where the old Verdreau homestead was gradually sinking back into the earth. To his drug-jacked ears and condition-red brain, they sounded like a herd of buffalo looking for the nearest waterhole. He scurried to the front of the truck and knelt with his gun braced on the bumper. The grenades which had been hung from the barrel of God's warrior now lay on the ground behind him. Sweat gleamed on his skinny, pimple-studded back. The door opener was clipped to the waistband of his ribbit pajamas. "Be patient," he counseled himself. "You don't know how many there are. Let them get out into the open before you start shooting, then mow them down in a hurry." He scattered several extra clips for God's warrior in front of him and waited, hoping to Christ Andy wouldn't have to whistle. Hoping he wouldn't either. It was possible they could still get out of this and live to fight another day.
13.
Freddy Denton reached the edge of the woods, pushed a fir bough aside with the barrel of his rifle, and peered out. He saw an overgrown hayfield with the radio tower in the middle of it, emitting a low hum he seemed to feel in the fillings of his teeth. A fence posted with signs reading "High Voltage" surrounded it. To the far left of his position was the one-story brick studio building. In between was a big red barn. He assumed the barn was for storage, or making drugs, or both. Marty Arsenault eased in beside him. Circles of sweat darkened his uniform. His eyes looked terrified.
"What's that truck doing there?"
he asked, pointing with the barrel of his gun.
"That's the Meals on Wheels truck," Freddy said. "For shut-ins and such. Haven't you seen that around town?"
"Seen it and helped load it," Marty said. "I gave up the Catholics for a Holy Redeemer last year. How come it's not inside the barn?" He said barn the Yankee way, making it sound like the cry of a discontented sheep.
"How do I know, and why would I care?" Freddy asked. "They're in the studio."
"How do you know?"
"Because that's where the TV is, and the big show out of the dome is on all the channels."
Marty raised his HK.
"Let me put a few rounds in that truck just to be sure. It could be booby-trapped, or they could be inside it."
Freddy pushed the barrel down.
"Jesus, please, are you crazy? They don't know we're here, and you just want to give it away? Did your mother have any kids that lived?"
"Fuck you," Marty said.
He considered.
"And fuck your mother, too."
Freddy looked back over his shoulder.
"Come on, you guys, we'll cut across the field to the studio. Look through the back windows and make sure of their positions."
He grinned.
"Smooth sailing."
Aubrey Toll, a man of few words, said, "We'll see." 14. In the truck that had remained on Little Bitch Road, Fern Bowie said, "I don't hear nothing." "You will," Randolph said. "Just wait." It was 12:02. 15. Chef watched as the bitter men broke cover and began moving diagonally across the field toward the rear of the studio. Three were wearing actual police uniforms. The other four had on blue shirts that Chef guessed were supposed to be uniforms. He recognized Lauren Connery, an old customer from his pot-peddling days, and Stubby Norman, the local junkman. He also recognized Mel Searles, another old customer and a friend of Junior's, also a friend of the late Frank the Lesseps, which probably meant he was one of the guys who had raped Sammy. Well, he wouldn't be raping anyone else. Not after today. 7. On this side, at least. On Sanders, who knew? He waited for more. And when no more came, he got to his feet, planted his elbows on the hood of the panel truck, and shouted, "Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, cruel both with wrath and fierce anger, to lay the land desolate." Their heads snapped around, but for a moment they froze, neither trying to raise their weapons nor scatter. They weren't cops at all, Chef saw, just birds on the ground, too dumb to fly. "And he shall destroy the sinners out of it. Isaiah 13, Silla, motherfuckers." With this homily and call to judgment, Chef opened fire, raking them from left to right. Two of the uniformed cops and Stubby Norman flew backward like broken dolls, painting the high trash grass with their blood. The paralysis of the survivors broke. Two turned and fled toward the woods. Connery and the last of the uniformed cops booked for the studio. Chef tracked them and opened fire again. The Kalashnikov burped a brief burst, and then the clip was empty. Connery clapped her hand to the back of her neck as if stung, went face down into the grass, kicked twice, and was still. The other one, a bald guy, made it to the rear of the studio. Chef didn't care too much about the pair who'd run for the woods, but he didn't want to let Baldy get away. If Baldy got around the corner of the building, he was apt to see Sanders, and might shoot him in the back. Chef grabbed a fresh clip and rammed it home with the heel of his hand. 16. Frederick Howard Denton, a.k.a. Baldy, wasn't thinking about anything when he reached the back of the WCIK studio. He had seen the Connery girl go down with her throat blown out, and that was the end of rational consideration. All he knew now was that he didn't want his picture on the honor wall. He had to get undercover, and that meant inside. There was a door. Behind it, some gospel group was singing, "We'll Join Hands Around the Throne." Freddy grabbed the knob. It refused to turn. Locked. He dropped his gun, raised the hand which had been holding it, and screamed, "I surrender! Don't shoot! I sur—" Three heavy blows boxed him low in the back. He saw a splash of red hit the door and had time to think, "We should have remembered the body armor." Then he crumpled, still holding onto the knob with one hand as the world rushed away from him. Everything he was and everything he'd ever known diminished to a single burning bright point of light. Then it went out. His hand slipped off the knob. He died on his knees, leaning against the door. 17. Melvin Searles didn't think either. Mel had seen Marty Arsenault, George Frederick, and Stubby Norman cut down in front of him. He had felt at least one bullet wicker right in front of his motherfucking eyes, and those kinds of things were not conducive to thought. Mel just ran. He blundered back through the trees, oblivious to the branches that whipped against his face, falling once and getting back up, finally bursting into the clearing where the trucks were. Firing one up and driving it away would have been the most reasonable course of action, but Mel and Reason had parted company. He probably would have sprinted straight down the access road to Little Bitch if the other survivor of the backdoor raiding party hadn't grabbed him by the shoulder and shoved him against the trunk of a large pine. It was Aubrey Toll, the bookstore owner's brother. He was a big, shambling, pale-eyed man who sometimes helped his brother Ray stocking the shelves but rarely said much. There were people in town who thought Aubrey was simple-minded. But he didn't look simple now. Nor did he look panicked. "I'm going back and get that son of a whore," he informed Mel. "Good luck to you, buddy," Mel said. He pushed away from the tree and turned toward the access road again. Aubrey Toll shoved him back harder this time. He brushed his hair out of his eyes, then pointed his Heckler Koch rifle at Mel's midsection.
You ain't going anywhere.
From behind them came another rattle of gunfire and screams.
Do you hear that? Mel asked. You want to go back into that?
Aubrey looked at him patiently.
You don't have to come with me, but you're going to cover me. Do you understand that? You do that or I'll shoot you, myself.
18. Chief Randolph's face split in a taut grin. The enemy is engaged at the rear of our objective, all according to plan. Roll, Stuart. Straight up the driveway. We'll disembark and cut through the studio.
What if they're in the barn? Stuart asked.
Then we'll still be able to hit them from behind. Now roll, before we miss it.
Stuart Bowie rolled.
19. Andy heard the gunfire from behind the storage building, but Chef didn't whistle, and so he stayed where he was, snug behind his tree. He hoped everything was going all right back there, because now he had his own problems, a town truck preparing to turn into the station's driveway. Andy circled his tree as it came, always keeping the oak between him and the truck. It stopped. The doors opened and four men got out. Andy was pretty sure that three of them were the ones who'd come out here before, and about Mr. Chicken there was no doubt. Andy would have recognized those beshitted green gum-rubber boots anywhere. Bitter men. Andy had no intention of letting them blindside the chef. He emerged from behind the tree and began walking straight up the middle of the driveway, Claudette held across his chest in the port arms position. His feet crunched on the gravel, but there was plenty of sound cover. Stuart had left the truck running, and loud gospel music was pouring from the studio. He raised the Kalashnikov, but made himself wait. Let them bunch together if they're going to. As they approached the front door of the studio, they did indeed bunch together.
Well, it's Mr. Chicken and all his friends, Andy said in a passable John Wayne drawl. How you doing, boys?
They started to turn. For you, Chef, Andy thought, and opened fire. He killed both Bowie brothers and Mr. Chicken with his first fusillade. Randolph he only winged. Andy popped the clip as Chef Bushy had taught him, grabbed another from the waistband of his pants, and slammed it home. Chief Randolph was crawling toward the door of the studio with blood pouring down his right arm and leg. He looked back over his shoulder, his peering eyes huge and bright in his sweaty face.
Please, Andy, he whispered. Our orders weren't to hurt you, only to bring you back so you could work with Jim.
Right, Andy said, and actually laughed. Don't bullshit a bullshitter. You were going to take all this.
A long, stuttering blast of gunfire erupted behind the studio. Chef might be in trouble. Might need him. Andy raised Claudette.
Please, don't kill me,
Randolph screamed. He put a hand over his face.
Just think about the roast beef dinner you'll be eating with Jesus, Andy said.
Why, 3 seconds from now, you'll be spreading your napkin. The sustained blast from the Kalashnikov rolled Randolph almost all the way to the studio door. Then, Andy ran for the rear of the building, ejecting the partially used clip and putting in a full one as he went. From the field came a sharp, piercing whistle.
I'm coming, Chef, Andy shouted. Hold on. I'm coming.
Something exploded. 20.
You cover me, Aubrey said grimly from the edge of the woods.
He had taken off his shirt, torn it in two, and cinched half of it around his forehead, apparently going for the Rambo look.
And if you're thinking about scragging me, you better get it right the first time, because if you don't, I'll come back here and cut your goddamn throat.
I'll cover you, Mel promised.
And he would. At least from here at the edge of the woods, he'd be safe. Probably.
That crazy tweaker is not getting away with this, Aubrey said.
He was breathing rapidly, psyching himself up.
That loser, that druggy fuck, and raising his voice, I'm coming for you, you nutbag druggy fuck.
Chef had emerged from behind the Meals on Wheels truck to look at his kill. He redirected his attention to the woods just as Aubrey Toll burst from them, screaming at the top of his lungs. Then Mel began to fire, and although the burst was nowhere near him,
Chef crouched instinctively. When he did, the garage door opener tumbled from the sagging waistband of his pajama pants and into the grass. He bent to get it, and that was when Aubrey opened up with his own automatic rifle. Bullet holes stitched a crazy course up the side of the Meals on Wheels truck, making hollow punching sounds in the metal and smashing the passenger side window to glistening crumbs. A bullet whined off the strip of metal at the side of the windshield. Chef abandoned the garage door opener and returned fire. But the element of surprise was gone, and Aubrey Toll was no sitting duck. He was weaving from side to side and heading toward the radio tower. It wouldn't provide cover, but it would clear Searles's line of fire. Aubrey's clip ran dry, but the last bullet in it grooved the left side of Chef's head. Blood flew, and a clump of hair fell onto one of Chef's thin shoulders, where it stuck in his sweat. Chef plopped down on his ass, momentarily lost his hold on God's warrior, then regained it. He didn't think he was seriously wounded, but it was high time for Sanders to come if he could still do so. Chef Bushy stuck two fingers in his mouth and whistled. Aubrey Toll reached the fence surrounding the radio tower just as Mel opened fire again, from the edge of the woods. Mel's target this time was the rear end of the Meals on Wheels truck. The slugs tore it open in metal hooks and flowers. The gas tank exploded, and the truck's rear half rose on a cushion of flame. Chef felt monstrous heat bake against his back and had time to think of the grenades. Would they blow? He saw the man by the radio tower aiming at him, and suddenly there was a clear choice. Shoot back, or grab the door opener. He chose the door opener, and as his hands closed on it, the air around him was suddenly full of unseen buzzing bees. One stung his shoulder, another punched into his side and rearranged his intestines. Chef Bushy tumbled and rolled over, once more losing his grip on the door opener. He reached for it, and another swarm of bees filled the air around him. He crawled into the high grass, leaving the door opener where it was, now only hoping for Sanders. The man from the radio tower, one brave, bitter man among seven, Chef thought, yea, verily, was walking toward him. God's warrior was very heavy now. His whole body was heavy. But Chef managed to get to his knees and pull the trigger. Nothing happened. Either the clip was empty or it had jammed.
You numb fuck, Aubrey Toll said. You nutbag tweaker. Tweak on this fuckhead.
Claudette! Sanders screamed. Toll wheeled around, but he was too late. There was a short, hard rattle of gunfire, and four Chinese slugs tore most of Aubrey's head from his shoulders.
Chef! Andy screamed and ran to where his friend knelt in the grass, blood streaming from his shoulder, side, and temple. The entire left side of Chef's face was red and wet.
Chef! Chef!
He fell to his knees and hugged Chef. Neither of them saw Mel Searles, the last man standing, emerge from the woods, and begin to walk cautiously toward them.
Get the trigger, Chef whispered.
What?
Andy looked down at Claudette's trigger for a moment, but that obviously wasn't what Chef meant.
Door opener, Chef whispered.
His left eye was drowning in blood. The other regarded Andy with bright and lucid intensity.
Door opener, Sanders.
Andy saw the garage door opener lying in the grass. He picked it up and handed it to the chef. Chef wrapped his hand around it.
You too, Sanders.
Andy curled his hand over Chef's hand.
I love you, Chef,
he said, and kissed Chef Bushy's dry, blood-freckled lips.
Love
you too, Sanders.
Hey, fags!
Mel cried with a kind of delirious joviality. He was standing just 10 yards away.
Get a room! No, wait, I got a better idea. Get a room in hell!
Now, Sanders, now.
Mel opened fire. Andy and Chef were driven sideways by the bullets, but before they were torn asunder, their joined hands pushed the white button marked open. The explosion was white and all-encompassing. 21. On the edge of the orchard, the Chester's Mill exiles are having a picnic lunch when gunfire breaks out. Not from 119, where the visiting continues, but to the southwest.
That's out on Little Bitch Road, Piper says. God, I wish we had some binoculars.
But they need none to see the yellow bloom that opens when the Meals on Wheels truck explodes.
Twitch is eating deviled chicken with a plastic spoon.
I don't know what's going on down there, but that's the radio station for sure, he says.
Rusty grabs Barbie's shoulder. That's where the propane is. They stockpiled it to make drugs. That's where the propane is.
Barbie has one moment of clear, premonitory terror. One moment when the worst is still ahead. Then, 4 miles distant, a brilliant white spark flicks the hazy sky, like a stroke of lightning that goes up, instead of down. A moment later, a titanic explosion hammers a hole straight through the center of the day. A red ball of fire blots out first the WCIK tower, then the trees behind it, and then the whole horizon as it spreads north and south. The people on Black Ridge scream but are unable to hear themselves over the vast grinding building roar as 80 pounds of plastic explosive and 10,000 gallons of propane undergo an explosive change. They cover their eyes and stagger backward, stepping on their sandwiches and spilling their drinks. Thurston snatches Alice and Aiden into his arms, and for a moment Barbie sees his face against the blackening sky. The long and terrified face of a man observing the literal gates of hell swing open and the ocean of fire waiting just beyond.
We have to go back to the farmhouse, Barbie yells.
Julia is clinging to him, crying. Beyond her is Joe McClatchy, trying to help his weeping mother to her feet. These people are going nowhere, at least for a while. To the southwest, where most of Little Bitch Road will, within the next 3 minutes, cease to exist, the yellowy-blue sky is turning black, and Barbie has time to think with perfect calm. Now we're under the magnifying glass. The blast shatters every window in the mostly deserted downtown, sends shutters soaring, knocks telephone poles askew, rips doors from their hinges, flattens mailboxes. Up and down Main Street, car alarms go off. To Big Jim Rennie and Carter Thibodeau, it feels as if the conference room has been struck by an earthquake. The TV is still on. Wolf Blitzer is asking, in tones of real alarm, "What's that?" "Anderson Cooper, Candy Crowley, Chad Myers, Soledad O'Brien, does anybody know what the hell that was? What's going on?" At the Dome, America's newest TV stars are looking around, showing the cameras only their backs as they shield their eyes and stare toward town. One camera pans up briefly for a moment, disclosing a monstrous column of black smoke and swirling debris on the horizon. Carter gets to his feet. Big Jim grabs his wrist. "One quick look," Big Jim says, "to see how bad it is, then get your butt back down here. We may have to go to the fallout shelter." "Okay." Carter races up the stairs, broken glass from the mostly vaporized front doors crunches beneath his boots as he runs down the hall. What he sees when he comes out on the steps is so beyond anything he has ever imagined that it tumbles him back into childhood again, and for a moment he freezes where he is, thinking, it's like the biggest, awfulest thunderstorm anyone ever saw, only worse. The sky to the west is a red-orange inferno surrounded by billowing clouds of deepest ebony. The air is already stenchy with exploded LP. The sound is like the roar of a dozen steel mills running at full blast. Directly above him, the sky is dark with fleeing birds. The sight of them, birds with nowhere to go, is what breaks Carter's paralysis. That, and the rising wind he feels against his face. There has been no wind in Chester's mill for 6 days, and this one is both hot and vile, stinking of gas and vaporized wood. A huge smashed oak lands in Main Street, pulling down snarls of dead electrical cable. Carter flees back down the corridor. Big Jim is standing at the head of the stairs, his heavy face pale and frightened, and for once, irresolute.
"Downstairs," Carter says. "Fallout shelter. It's coming. The fire's coming. And when it gets here, it's going to eat this town alive."
Big Jim groans. "What did those idiots do?" Carter doesn't care. Whatever they did, it's done. If they don't move quickly, they will be done, too.
"Is there air purifying machinery down there, boss?"
"Yes."
"Hooked to the Jenny?"
"Yes, of course."
"Thank Christ for that. Maybe we got a chance."
Helping Big Jim down the stairs to make him move more quickly, Carter only hopes they don't cook alive down there. The doors of Dipper's Roadhouse have been chocked open. But the force of the explosion breaks the chocks and sweeps the doors shut. The glass coughs inward, and several of the people standing at the back of the dance floor are cut. Henry Morrison's brother Whit suffers a slashed jugular. The crowd stampedes toward the doors, the big screen TV completely forgotten. They trample poor Whit Morrison as he lies dying in a spreading pool of his own blood. They hit the doors, and more people are lacerated as they push through the jagged openings. "Birds!" someone cries. "Ah, God! Look at all them birds!" But most of them look west, instead of up. West, where burning doom is rolling down upon them below a sky that is now midnight black and full of poison air. Those who can run take a cue from the birds and begin trotting, jogging, or flat-out galloping straight down the middle of Route 117. Several others throw themselves into their cars, and there are multiple fender benders in the gravel parking lot where, once upon an antique time, Dale Barbara took a beating. Velma Winters gets into her old Datsun pickup and, after avoiding the demolition derby in the parking lot, discovers her right-of-way to the road is blocked by fleeing pedestrians. She looks right, at the firestorm billowing toward them like some great burning dress, eating the woods between Little Bitch and downtown, and drives blindly ahead in spite of the people in her way. She strikes Carla Venziano, who is fleeing with her infant in her arms. Velma feels the truck jounce as it passes over their bodies and resolutely blocks her ears to Carla's shrieks as her back is broken and baby Stephen is crushed to death beneath her. All Velma knows is that she has to get out of here. Somehow, she has to get out. At the dome, the reunions have been ended by an apocalyptic party crasher. Those on the inside have something more important than relatives to occupy them now. The giant mushroom cloud that's growing to the northwest of their position, rising on a muscle of fire already almost a mile high. The first feather of wind, the wind that has sent Carter and Big Jim fleeing for the fallout shelter, strikes them, and they cringe against the dome, mostly ignoring the people behind them. In any case, the people behind them are retreating. They're lucky. They can. Henrietta Clavard feels a cold hand wrap around hers. She turns and sees Petra Searles. Petra's hair has come loose from the clips that were holding it and hangs against her cheeks. "Got any more of that joy juice?" Petra asks and manages a ghastly Let's Party smile. "Sorry. All out," Henrietta says. "Well, maybe it doesn't matter." "Hang on to me, honey," Henrietta says. "Just hang on to me. We're gonna be okay." But when Petra looks into the old woman's eyes, she sees no belief and no hope. The party's almost over. "Look, now. Look and see. 800 people are crammed against the dome, their heads tilted up and their eyes wide, watching as their inevitable end rushes toward them. Here are Johnny and Carrie Carver, and Bruce Yardley, who worked at Food City. Here is Tabby Morell, who owns a lumberyard soon to be reduced to swirling ash, and his wife, Bonnie. Toby Manning, who clerked at the department store. Trina Cole and Donnie Barbeau. Wendy Goldstone with her friend and fellow teacher, Ellen Vandesteen. Bill Allnut, who wouldn't go get the bus. And his wife, Sarah, who is screaming for Jesus to save her as she watches the oncoming fire. Here are Todd Wendelstadt and Manuel Ortega with their faces raised dumbly to the west where the world is disappearing in smoke. Tommy and Willow Anderson, who will never book another band from Boston into their roadhouse. See them all. A whole town with its back to an invisible wall. Behind them, the visitors go from backing up to retreat and from retreat into full flight. They ignore the buses and pound straight down the highway toward Motton. A few soldiers hold position, but most throw their guns down, tear after the crowd, and look back no more than Lot look back at Sodom. Cox doesn't flee. Cox approaches the dome and shouts, "You! Officer in charge!" Henry Morrison turns, walks to the colonel's position, and braces his hands on a hard and mystic surface he can't see. Breathing has become difficult. Bad wind pushed by the firestorm hits the dome, swirls, then backdrafts toward the hungry thing that's coming. A black wolf with red eyes. Here, on the Motton town line, is the lamb fold where it will feed. "Help us," Henry says. Cox looks at the firestorm and estimates it will reach the crowd's current position in no more than 15 minutes, perhaps as few as 3. It's not a fire or an explosion in this closed and already polluted environment. It is a cataclysm.
"Sir, I cannot," he says.
Before Henry can reply, Joe Boxer grabs his arm. He is gibbering.
"Quit it, Joe," Henry says.
"There's nowhere to run and nothing to do but pray." But Joe Boxer does not pray. He is still holding his stupid little hawkshot pistol.
and after a final crazed look at the oncoming inferno, he puts the gun to his temple like a man playing Russian roulette. Henry makes a grab for it, but is too late. Boxer pulls the trigger. Nor does he die at once, although a gout of blood flies from the side of his head. He staggers away, waving the stupid little pistol like a handkerchief, screaming. Then he falls to his knees, throws his hands up once to the darkening sky like a man in the grip of a Godhead revelation, and collapses face first on the broken white line of the highway. Henry turns his stunned face back to Colonel Cox, who is simultaneously 3 feet and 1,000,000 miles away.
"I'm so sorry, my friend," Cox says.
Pamela Chen stumbles up. "The bus," she screams to Henry over the building roar. "We have to take the bus and drive straight through it. It's our only chance." Henry knows this is no chance at all, but he nods, gives Cox a final look. Cox will never forget the cop's hellish, despairing eyes. Takes Pammy Chen's hand and follows her to bus 19 as the smoky blackness races toward them. The fire reaches downtown and explodes along Main Street like a blowtorch in a pipe. The Peace Bridge is vaporized. Big Jim and Carter cringe in the fallout shelter as the town hall implodes above them. The PD sucks its brick walls in, then spews them high into the sky. The statue of Lucien Calvert is uprooted from its base in War Memorial Plaza. Lucien flies into the burning black with his rifle bravely raised. On the library lawn, the Halloween dummy with the jolly top hat and the garden trowel hands goes up in a sheet of flame. A great whooshing noise, it sounds like God's own vacuum cleaner, has arisen as the oxygen-hungry fire sucks in good air to fill its single poisonous lung. The buildings along Main Street explode, one after another, tossing their boards and goods and shingles and glass into the air like confetti on New Year's Eve. The abandoned movie house, Sanders' hometown drug, Burpee's department store, the gas and grocery, the bookstore, the flower shop, the barber shop. In the funeral parlor, the most recent additions to the roll of the dead begin roasting in their metal lockers like chickens in a Dutch oven. The fire finishes its triumphant run down Main Street by engulfing Food City, then rolls onward toward Dippers, where those still in the parking lot scream and clutch at each other. Their last sight on earth is of a firewall 100 yards high running eagerly to meet them, like Albion to his beloved. Now the flames are rolling down the main roads, boiling their tar into soup. At the same time, it is spreading into Eastchester, snacking on both yuppie homes and the few yuppies cowering inside. Michaela Burpee will soon run for her cellar, but too late. Her kitchen will explode around her, and her last sight on earth will be her Amana refrigerator melting. The soldiers standing by the Tarker-Chester border, closest to the origin of this catastrophe, stumble backward as the fire beats impotent fists against the dome, turning it black. The soldiers feel the heat bake through, raising the temperature 20 degrees in seconds, crisping the leaves on the nearest trees. One of them will later say, "It was like standing outside a glass ball with a nuclear explosion inside of it." Now the people cowering against the dome begin to be bombarded by dead and dying birds as the fleeing sparrows, robins, grackles, crows, gulls, and even geese slam against the dome they so quickly learn to avoid. And across Dinsmore's field comes a stampede of the town's dogs and cats. There are also skunks, woodchucks, porcupines. Deer leap among them and several clumsily galloping moose. And of course Alden Dinsmore's cattle, eyes rolling and mooing their distress. When they reach the dome, they crash against it. The lucky animals die. The unlucky ones lie sprawled on pincushions of broken bones, barking and squealing and meowing and bellowing. Ollie Dinsmore sees Dolly, the beautiful brown Swiss who once won him a 4-H blue ribbon. His mother named her, thought Ollie and Dolly was just so cute. Dolly gallops heavily toward the dome with somebody's Weimer on her nipping at her legs, which are already bloody. She hits the barrier with a crunch he can't hear over the oncoming fire. Except in his mind he can hear it. And somehow, seeing the equally doomed dog pounce on poor Dolly and begin ripping at her defenseless udder, is even worse than finding his father dead. The sight of the dying cow that was once his darling breaks the boy's paralysis. He doesn't know if there's even the slightest chance of surviving this terrible day, but he suddenly sees two things with utter clarity. One is the oxygen tank with his dead father's Red Sox cap hung on it. The other is Grampy Tom's oxygen mask, dangling from the hook of the bathroom door. As Ollie runs for the farm where he's lived his whole life, the farm that will soon cease to exist, he has only one completely coherent thought. The potato cellar. Buried under the barn and running beneath the hill behind it, the potato cellar may be safe. The expatriates are still standing at the edge of the orchard. Barbie hasn't been able to make them hear him, let alone move them. Yet he must get them back to the farmhouse and the vehicles. Soon. From here they have a panoramic view of the whole town, and Barbie is able to judge the fire's course the way a general might judge the most likely route of an invading army by aerial photographs. It's sweeping southeast, and may stay on the western side of the Prestille. The river, although dry, should still serve as a natural firebreak. The explosive windstorm the fire has generated will also help to keep it from the town's northernmost quadrant. If the fire burns all the way to where the dome borders on Castle Rock and Motton, the heel and sole of the boot, then those parts of Chester's Mill bordering on TR-90 and Northern Harlow may be saved. From fire, at least. But it's not fire that concerns him. What concerns him is that wind. He feels it now rushing over his shoulders and between his spread legs hard enough to ripple his clothes and blow Julia's hair around her face. It's rushing away from them to feed the fire. And because the mill is now an almost completely closed environment, there will be very little good air to replace what is being lost. Barbie has a nightmare image of goldfish floating dead on the surface of an aquarium from which all the oxygen has been exhausted. Julia turns to him before he can grab her and points at something below, a figure trudging along Black Ridge Road, pulling a wheeled object. From this distance, Barbie can't tell if the refugee is a man or a woman, and it doesn't matter. Whoever it is will almost certainly die of asphyxiation long before reaching the highland. He takes Julia's hand and puts his lips to her ear. We have to go. Grab Piper and have her grab whoever's next to her. Everybody. What about him? She shouts, still pointing to the trudging figure. It might be a child's wagon he or she's pulling. It's loaded with something that must be heavy because the figure is bent over and moving very slowly. Barbie has to make her understand because time has grown short. Never mind him. We're going back to the farmhouse. Now. Everybody joins hands so nobody gets left behind. She tries to turn and look at him, but Barbie holds her still. He wants her ear, literally, because he has to make her understand. If we don't go now, it may be too late. We'll run out of air. On Route 117, Velma Winter leads a parade of fleeing vehicles in her Datsun truck. All she can think about is the fire and smoke filling the rearview mirror. She's doing 70 when she hits the dome, which she has in her panic forgotten completely. Just another bird, in other words. This one on the ground. The collision occurs at the same spot where Billy and Wanda DeBeck, Nora Robichaux, and Elsa Andrews came to grief a week before, shortly after the dome came down. The engine of Velma's light truck shoots backward and tears her in half. Her upper body exits through the windshield, trailing intestines like party streamers, and splatters against the dome like a juicy bug. It is the start of a 12-vehicle pileup in which many die. The majority are only injured, but they will not suffer long. Henrietta and Petra feel the heat wash against them. So do all the hundreds pressed against the dome. The wind lifts their hair and ruffles clothes that will soon be burning. Take my hand, honey, Henrietta says, and Petra does. They watch the big yellow bus make a wide, drunken turn. It totters along the ditch, barely missing Richie Killian, who first dodges away and then leaps nimbly forward, grabbing onto the back door as the bus goes by. He lifts his feet and squats on the bumper. I hope they make it, Petra says. So do I, honey. But I don't think they will. Now some of the deer leaping out of the approaching conflagration are on fire. Henry has taken the wheel of the bus. Pamela stands beside him, holding onto a chrome pole. The passengers are about a dozen townsfolk, most loaded in earlier because they were experiencing physical problems. Among them are Mabel Alston, Mary Lou Costas, and Mary Lou's baby, still wearing Henry's baseball cap. The redoubtable Leo Lemoyne has also gotten on board, although his problem seems to be emotional rather than physical. He is wailing in terror. Step on it and head north, Pamela shouts. The fire has almost reached them. It's less than 500 yards ahead, and the sound of it shakes the world. Drive like a motherfucker and don't stop for anything. Henry knows it's hopeless, but because he also knows he would rather go out this way than helplessly cowering with his back to the dome, he yanks on the headlights and gets rolling. Pamela is thrown backward into the lap of Chaz Bender, the teacher. Chaz was helped into the bus when he began to suffer heart palpitations. He grabs Pammy to steady her. There are shrieks and cries of alarm, but Henry barely hears them. He knows he is going to lose sight of the road in spite of the headlights, but so what? As a cop, he has driven this stretch 1,000 times.
Use the force, Luke, he thinks,
and actually laughs as he drives into the flaming darkness with the accelerator pedal jammed to the mat. Clinging to the back door of the bus, Richie Killian suddenly cannot breathe. He has time to see his arms catch fire. A moment later, the temperature outside the bus pops to 800 degrees, and he is burned off his perch like a fleck of meat off a hot barbecue grill. The lights running down the center of the bus are on, casting a weak luncheonette at midnight glow over the terrified, sweat-drenched faces of the passengers, but the world outside has turned dead black. Whirlpools of ash eddy in the radically foreshortened beams of the headlights. Henry steers by memory, wondering when the tires will explode beneath him. He's still laughing, although he can't hear himself over the scalded cat screech of 19's engine. He's keeping to the road, there's that much. How long until they break through the other side of the firewall? Is it possible they can break through? He's beginning to think it might be. Good God, how thick can it be?
You're doing it! Pamela shouts. You're doing it!
Maybe, Henry thinks, maybe I am. But Christ, the heat! He is reaching for the air conditioning knob, meaning to turn it all the way to max cool, and that's when the windows implode and the bus fills with fire. Henry thinks, no, no, not when we're so close. But when the charred bus charges clear of the smoke, he sees nothing beyond but a black wasteland. The trees have been burned away to glowing stubs, and the road itself is a bubbling ditch. Then an overcoat of fire drops over him from behind, and Henry Morrison knows no more. 19 skids from the remains of the road and overturns with flame spewing from every broken window. The quickly blackening message on the back reads, "Slow down, friend. We love our children." Ollie Dinsmore sprints to the barn, wearing Grampy Tom's oxygen mask around his neck and carrying 2 tanks with a strength he never knew he had, the second he spied as he cut through the garage. The boy runs for the stairs that will take him down to the potato cellar. There's a ripping, snarling sound from overhead as the roof begins to burn. On the west side of the barn, the pumpkins also begin to burn, the smell rich and cloying, like Thanksgiving in hell. The fire moves toward the southern side of the dome, racing through the last 100 yards. There is an explosion as Dinsmore's dairy barns are destroyed. Henrietta Clavard regards the oncoming fire and thinks, well, I'm old, I've had my life. That's more than this poor girl can say. Turn around, honey, she tells Petra, and put your head on my bosom. Petra Searles turns a tear-stained and very young face up to Henrietta's. Will it hurt?
Only for a second, honey. Close your eyes, and when you open them, you'll be bathing your feet in a cool stream.
Petra speaks her last words.
That sounds nice.
She closes her eyes. Henrietta does the same. The fire takes them. At 1 second, they're there. At the next, gone. Cox is still close on the other side of the dome, and the cameras are still rolling from their safe position at the flea market site. Everyone in America is watching in shocked fascination. The commentators have been stunned to silence, and the only soundtrack is the fire, which has plenty to say. For a moment, Cox can still see the long human snake, although the people who make it up are only silhouettes against the fire. Most of them, like the expatriates on Black Ridge, who are at last making their way back to the farmhouse in their vehicles, are holding hands. Then the fire boils against the dome and they are gone. As if to make up for their disappearance, the dome itself becomes visible, a great charred wall rearing into the sky. It holds most of the heat in, but enough flashes out to turn Cox around and send him running. He tears off his smoking shirt as he goes. The fire has burned on the diagonal bar before Saw, sweeping across Chester's Mill from northwest to southeast. When it dies, it will do so with remarkable quickness. What it has taken is oxygen. What it leaves behind is methane, formaldehyde, hydrochloric acid, carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, and trace gases equally noxious. Also, choking clouds of particulate matter, vaporized houses, trees, and, of course, people. What it leaves behind is poison. 22. 28 exiles and two dogs convoyed out to where the dome bordered on TR-90, known to the old-timers as Canton. They were crammed into three vans, two cars, and the ambulance. By the time they arrived, the day had grown dark, and the air had become increasingly hard to breathe. Barbie jammed on the brakes of Julia's Prius and ran to the dome, where a concerned Army lieutenant colonel and half a dozen other soldiers stepped forward to meet him. The run was short, but by the time Barbie reached the red band spray-painted on the dome, he was gasping. The good air was disappearing like water down a sink. "The fans!" he panted at the lieutenant colonel. "Turn on the fans!" Claire McClatchy and Joe spilled out of the department store van, both of them staggering and gasping. The phone company van came next. Ernie Calvert got out, took two steps, and went to his knees. Nori and her mother tried to help him to his feet. Both were crying. "Colonel Barbara, what happened?" the lieutenant colonel asked. According to the name strip on his fatigues, he was Stringfellow. "Report!"
"Fuck your report," Romy shouted.
He was holding a semi-conscious child, Aiden Appleton, in his arms. Thirst Marshall staggered along behind him with his arm around Alice, whose sparkle-sprinkled top was sticking to her. She'd retched down her front.
"Fuck your report. Just turn on those fans, you."
Stringfellow gave the order, and the refugees knelt, their hands pressed against the dome. Greedily gasping in the faint breeze of clean air, the huge fans were able to force through the barrier. Behind them, the fire raged.
Survivors.
1.
Only 397 of the mill's 2,000 residents survived the fire, most of them in the northeast quadrant of town. By the time night falls, rendering the smudged darkness inside the dome complete, there will be 106. When the sun comes up on Saturday morning, shining weakly through the only part of the dome not charred completely black, the population of Chester's Mill is just 32. 2. Ollie slammed the door to the potato cellar before running downstairs. He also flicked the switch that turned on the lights, not knowing if they would still work. They did. As he stumbled down to the barn's basement, chilly now, but not for long, he could already feel the heat starting to push in behind him. Ollie remembered the day 4 years ago when the guys from Ives Electric in Castle Rock backed up to the barn to unload the new Honda generator.
"Overpriced son of a whore, better work right," Alden had said, chewing on a piece of grass. "Because I'm in hock up to my eyeballs for it."
It had worked right. It was still working right, but Ollie knew it wouldn't much longer. The fire would take it as the fire had taken everything else. If he had as much as a minute of light left, he would be surprised. "I may not even be alive in a minute." The potato grater stood in the middle of the dirty concrete floor, a complexity of belts and chains and gears that looked like some ancient instrument of torture. Beyond it was a huge pile of spuds. It had been a good fall for them, and the Dinsmores had finished the harvest only 3 days before the dome came down. In an ordinary year, Alden and his boys would have graded them all through November to sell at the Castle Rock Co-op Produce Market and various roadside stands in Motton, Harlow, and Tarker's Mills. No spud money this year, but Ollie thought they might save his life. He ran to the edge of the pile, then stopped to examine the two tanks. The dial on the one from the house read only half full, but the needle on the one from the garage was all the way in the green. Ollie let the half-full one clank to the concrete and attached the mask to the one from the garage. He had done this many times when Grampy Tom was alive, and it was the work of seconds. Just as he hung the mask around his neck again, the lights went out. The air was growing warmer. He dropped to his knees and began burrowing into the cold weight of the potatoes, pushing with his feet, protecting the long tank with his body and yanking it along beneath him with one hand. With the other, he made awkward swimming motions. He heard potatoes avalanche down behind him and fought a panicky urge to back out. It was like being buried alive, and telling himself that if he wasn't buried alive, he'd surely die didn't help much. He was gasping, coughing, seeming to breathe in as much potato dirt as air. He clapped the oxygen mask over his face and... nothing. He fumbled at the tank valve for what seemed like forever, his heart pounding in his chest like an animal in a cage. Red flowers began to open in the darkness behind his eyes. Cold vegetable weight bore down on him. He had been crazy to do this, as crazy as Rory had been, shooting off a gun at the dome, and he was going to pay the price. He was going to die. Then his fingers finally found the valve. At first it wouldn't turn, and he realized he was trying to spin it the wrong way. He reversed his fingers, and a rush of cool, blessed air gusted into the mask. Ollie lay under the potatoes, gasping. He jumped a little when the fire blew in the door at the top of the stairs. For a moment, he could actually see the dirty cradle he lay in. It was getting warmer, and he wondered if the half-full tank he had left behind would blow. He also wondered how much additional time the full one had bought him, and if it was worth it. But that was his brain. His body had only one imperative, and that was life. Ollie began to crawl deeper into the potato pile, dragging the tank along, adjusting the mask on his face each time it came askew. 3. If the Vegas bookies had given odds on those likely to survive the Visitor's Day catastrophe, those on San Verdreau would have been 1,000 to 1. But longer odds have been beaten. It's what keeps bringing people back to the tables. And Sam was the figure Julia had spotted laboring along Black Ridge Road shortly before the expatriates ran for the vehicles at the farmhouse. Sloppy Sam, the canned heat man, lived for the same reason Ollie did. He had oxygen. 4 years ago, he had gone to see Dr. Haskell, the Whiz. You remember him? When Sam said he couldn't seem to catch his breath just lately, Dr. Haskell listened to the old rumpot's wheezing respiration and asked him how much he smoked.
Well, Sam had said, I used to go through as much as 4 packs a day when I was in the woods, but now that I'm on disability and sociable security, I've cut back some.
Dr. Haskell asked him what that meant in terms of actual consumption. Sam said he guessed he was down to 2 packs a day.
American Eagles. I used to smoke Chester Foggies, but now they only come with a filter, he explained. Also, they're expensive. Eagles is cheap, and you can pick the filter off before you light up. Easy as pie.
Then he began to cough. Dr. Haskell found no lung cancer, something of a surprise. But the x-ray seemed to show a damn fine case of emphysema, and he told Sam that he'd probably be using oxygen for the rest of his life. It was a bad diagnosis, but give the guy a break. As the doctors say, when you hear hoofbeats, you don't think zebras. Also, folks have a tendency to see what they're looking for, don't they? And although Dr. Haskell died what might be called a hero's death, no one, including Rusty Everett, ever mistook him for Gregory House. What Sam actually had was bronchitis, and it cleared up not too long after the Whiz made his diagnosis. By then, however, Sam was signed up for oxygen deliveries every week from Castles in the Air, a company based in Castle Rock, of course, and he never canceled the service. Why would he? Like his hypertension medicine, the oxygen was covered by what he referred to as the medical. Sam didn't really understand the medical, but he understood that the oxygen cost him nothing out of pocket. He also discovered that huffing pure oxygen had a way of cheering a body up. Sometimes, however, weeks would pass before it crossed Sam's mind to visit the scourgy little shed he thought of as the oxygen bar. Then when the guys from Castles in the Air came to retrieve the empties, a thing they were often lax about, Sam would go out to his oxygen bar, open the valves, run the tanks dry, pile them in his son's old red wagon, and trundle them out to the bright blue truck with the air bubbles on it. If he had still lived out on Little Bitch Road, site of the old Verdreau home place, Sam would have burned to a crisp, as Marta Edmonds did, in the minutes after the initial explosion. But the home place and the woodlots which had once surrounded it had been taken for unpaid taxes long since, and purchased back in 08 by one of several Jim Rennie dummy corporations at bargain basement rates. His baby sis owned a little patch of land out on God Creek, however, and that was where Sam was residing on the day the world blew up. The shack wasn't much, and he had to do his business in an outhouse. The only running water was supplied by an old hand pump in the kitchen. But by gory, the taxes were paid, little sis saw to that, and he had the medical. Sam was not proud of his part in instigating the Food City riot. He had drunk many shots and beers with Georgia Rue's father over the years, and felt bad about hitting the man's daughter in the face with a rock. He kept thinking about the sound that piece of quartz had made when it connected, and how Georgia's broken jaw had sagged.